been another one of those weeks, hasn't it? The markets went nuts, the presidential primaries got even more chaotic, and we said a sad farewell to Ziggy Stardust and Severus Snape. That would be David Bowie and Alan Rickman. Now the week's over, and we can take a little breather. It's time for Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, in for Lizzie. On today's show, we're going to hear the stories in your economy, learn about just what the heck is going on in China's economy, and check out the social media network of the hour. That would be Peach. You want to be a Peach? Visit us at MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Last week, we asked that classic political question, whether you're better off now than you were 4 years ago. And we're keeping the conversation going this week because so many of you wrote and called in. There were listeners like Heidi Kaltenhauser, who've bounced back in some ways, but not in others.
You know, to answer your question, if I'm doing better or worse than I was 4 years ago, I have a kind of a yes and no answer to that. And the yes part is that my investments are doing better. The stock market's better. My house is improved in values. From that standpoint, I am doing better.
And what about other factors? You said you're in the same job. Have you seen your pay go up at all? Have you seen any other bennies come your way?
Well, and I think that's kind of the no answer to that question, is that even though my investments have done well, so my net worth has actually increased in the last 4 years, my compensation package just kind of lost some ground. When you roll up everything you get, it's kind of going backwards, and it's really impacted my lifestyle. I just don't have the money to do the kind of things I used to do.
Well, presuming you're not selling off your rising stocks and taking a capital gains hit, how are you adjusting your lifestyle to deal with the other factors?
Well, you know, I'm pretty good at staying focused on my goals. I have a 12-year-old daughter, need to get her through college, need to retire, need to pay off my mortgage, and I've been able to continue to do that over the last 4 years. But in order to do that, I just don't have those sweet little perks that I used to have. I just can't eat out at restaurants like I used to, take the vacations I used to, just other purchases and activities. I've had to alter those type of expenditures in order to keep putting money in for what is important to me.
Would you say, generally speaking, that things are on the upswing for you? Are you feeling upbeat about your fiscal future?
You know, I do feel upbeat because I think there's a lot better job market than there's been in the last 4 years. And I have a good education. I work hard. In the past, that's been able to, you know, get me moving upward continually. But in the last few years, that hasn't been the case. So I am feeling a little more positive, though, definitely.
Heidi, keep us posted, okay?
I will do that.
There were also people like Mary Tilgen, who managed to turn things around.
4 years ago, I was in community college and also working at the same time. So I would just wake up every morning, go to school, get immediately off from school, go to work until about 10 at night, go to bed, get back up at like 6 in the morning, go back to school. I was struggling to pay tuition and get through the day, but I mean, I kind of made it.
So how did you pull yourself out of that cycle?
Well, my sister started to think about going to college and everything. My parents couldn't help me with it, so I was struggling as it was. But knowing that my sister was going to go to college soon, I decided that I should probably enlist into the Navy. My dad was in the Navy too, so.
So you knew a thing or two about this from your dad's experience?
Yes, yeah. He put himself through college while he was enlisted, and he was able to support myself and my mom at the same exact time.
Mary, there's going to be a lot of people listening to this thinking, wow, that sounds like she's really gotten her act together and has created a lot of opportunities for herself. I know you're not in the recruiting division, but is this a smart play for people, especially young people who might be trying to get their life accelerated?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a good way to go to college, especially if you just do your 4 and then get out. But then it also gives you a lot of time to think, because I definitely had one thing that I wanted to do really badly. But now that I've enlisted, it's completely changed over the last about 3 years. So I'm glad that I took that time, even if I stay in or get out, to think about what I want to do.
All right. That's really awesome. Mary, first of all, thank you for your service. Second of all, very impressed at how you've gotten everything together. Best of luck with that.
Thank you.
And others like Lisa Keller, whose life was changed by the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, I was without health care and still struggling financially to hold down a job and just not recovered economically.
So you had a job that didn't provide insurance?
Right. I think I was unemployed in 2012 and doing part-time work as I could find it, either in home care or other jobs.
And I would imagine not having insurance for someone like you, a cancer survivor, must have been extremely frightening.
It was. I had things I needed to take care of, but I was struggling to even keep a primary doctor, let alone different things that came up just in the course of needing to go see a doctor.
Tell me what it was like to suddenly be covered, to suddenly have insurance after so long without.
Feels like you're joining the human race, you know, of like, I don't have to sit and be frustrated and then have people ask me, well, why aren't you working? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? It's like, nobody's listening. I have to go to a doctor, but, no, you know, it just seemed crazy, and it just seemed like, it just felt like I was going to be able to function and do things I needed to do and get that weight off my shoulders.
How's your health these days?
Very good. Thank you for asking.
Lisa Keller, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who wrote and called in. Next week, when it comes to your money and your personal economy, what should top the next president's to-do list? Why? What's in it for you? Tell us at MarketplaceWeekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-648-5114. Business has its own language. Sometimes that language includes the terms long and short. That's long as in betting on something, or short as in betting against something. You've heard these words. Now, we like to do that here, too, but with the news. To tell us where they're long and short this week, we're joined by Andrea Chang. She's assistant business editor at the LA Times. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, David.
And also the esteemed associate producer of Marketplace Weekend, Raghu Manavalan.
Thank you for having me.
Well, great. Okay, so let's start with you, Andrea. Long and short. What are you long this week?
I really hate to say this because I personally am not a fan, but this week I'm long on Snapchat.
Why?
Well, they're making a big push into the over 35 market, which, if you know Snapchat, is kind of opposite of what they've always been doing, which is targeting the teen market. And it seems to be working. So on Monday, President Obama and the White House joined Snapchat.
Get out.
Yes. The day before the State of the Union address, they got on Snapchat. And then the morning of the State of the Union, they were snapping all sorts of posts from inside the White House to give people a behind-the-scenes look at what was going on in the hours leading up to that address.
And Western civilization didn't collapse.
Not yet.
What I keep hearing is how people stop using Facebook because their mom is on it. I'm curious to see what happens when they try to make that turn towards, you know, parents and grandparents getting on Snapchat.
They'll become instantly uncool.
Exactly. Yeah. They'll all have to go to Peach, right?
Ooh, not Peach. I'm holding out for Mangosteen anyway.
There you go. I mean, lychee, perhaps.
So what are you short?
I am short on Yahoo.
Wait a minute. Long Snapchat, short Yahoo.
I know.
Okay, now everyone's betting against Yahoo at the moment.
Exactly, and me too. But, I'm just getting to that point where I'm so frustrated. I, you know, was covering tech for years until really last week, actually, and I feel like I've had it. I've had it with Marissa Meyer. I've had it with Yahoo. Nothing is happening. Everything's a mess. You know, the latest news is they're talking about laying off 10% of their staff, and it's just like this is something that just – the turnaround isn't happening, and I've had it.
Wow. You kind of have to wonder what's even left for them to fail at. You know, they had their video service fail. You know, Tumblr has pretty much stayed stagnant whole time.
Well, somebody buys them at this point.
Yeah, I guess,
and then they become
maybe
a component
happens,
of something else.
Sure. Yeah. But, I mean, no one uses their search engine anymore or something like
Do
that.
Do they even have one? I thought they'd farm that out to Google.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What about you, Raghu?
I'm going to go short NFL to Los Angeles. I mean, I'm a big sports guy. I'm happy for the city. It's 20 years in the making. I'm happy about the tax revenue, the jobs, all that sort of thing. But just watching that happen and just seeing this bidding war between cities and fans just being left out in the dust after following a team for 20 years. And, you know, now the Raiders are talking about moving. The Chargers want to move too. You know, one of them will move to St. Louis. Another will move to San Antonio. Then a team from, you know, Cincinnati will move to Minnesota or something. It just kind of tired. Like, there's no loyalty anymore, it seems like.
It's all about enriching the owners.
years.
Exactly.
And what's that about?
Because they don't have enough
That's
money.
That's not how the world works.
Yeah.
No, rich people don't get richer. It's
what's
all about the common man, you know, loving their team. And it's
all right. Well, if you're short one of our great American pastimes, what are you long?
I am long on the stock market. It's all the fun about the Powerball, but stretched over about 30 or 40 years. And everyone makes money at the end.
Everybody. It's like an ATM.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, you just have to wait and just keep holding on to that stock and just goes up and up. I mean, I know we had a rough couple weeks on it, but as we keep saying on this show, don't worry about the week-to-week blips. Just let it happen. Just stay passive.
You and Warren Buffett right there.
There you go. I mean, works for him, works for me.
Now, in my case, I'm thinking about that video that was all the rage this week of some guy in New York giving his shirt to a homeless guy on the subway. I'm long kindness this
week.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We'll post the video on the website. I just think it's so cool when things like that happen. And the guy even got honored by the city for doing it. So I'm long kindness. I'm short the lottery. Not because I didn't win, which I did not. I'm short because I'm a bright guy and I know better. And I never, ever play the lottery, except now.
Okay.
And I played it because everyone else was playing it. And what is that? That has to be pure greed. That just, you know,
I
kick myself for that.
Sure. I will say I did enjoy the, like, 10 seconds of communal experience we had from it, you know. I was talking to tons of people about what they would do with the money, even though we would never win, you know.
So. It was fun to dream, even if it was just for the 10 seconds.
Yeah, but, you know, we all know better. Everyone listening knows better, and I'll bet everyone listening bought a ticket.
Right.
All right,
or so, many.
Or many. Any sense of where you guys might be long in the future? Do you got any storm clouds on the horizon?
I mean, I was honestly going to be long on football in L.A., mm-hmm. so I'm sad that you're short on it, because I'm really excited about
I
that.
I am, too. Yeah. Thank you very much. The Rams?
Years.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't really looking forward to the Raiders coming, I have to be honest, being a Bay Area girl, but I'm excited about the Rams. When you talk about loyalty, they started here, so
That's true.
They are kind of coming back home.
Yeah, I used to see them as a kid. With the Raiders, it's not so much the loyalty thing, it's rather I'm a little afraid of their fans.
Same here.
Right. Andrea Chang, Raghu Madhavan, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
A marketplace, we like to zero in on the big and the small numbers defining the world of business. And every day, our By the Numbers blog explores the stories behind those numbers on our website, marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with this week's news, By the Numbers. Tobin?
Thanks, David. Our first number is
30,000.
That's how many people Starbucks employs in China.
Its 2,000th store just opened there this week.
On Tuesday, the company announced it'll begin offering its workers a monthly housing stipend, an amount that will cover, on average, 50% of their housing expenses.
8.5%.
That's this past year's jump in job listings for economics PhDs, according to a new report from the American Economic Association.
With movies like The Big Short getting Oscar nods and making the financial crisis seem sexy, a lot more undergrads are finding a reason to choose a major in economics.
Are you kidding, Tobin? Marketplace has been making financial crises sexy for years.
12.
That's the date in August Jonathan Nichols figured out what was wrong with his new phone number.
Nichols had been getting unexplained calls from luxury car companies and sexy pictures from complete strangers.
Then he figured it out. See... The phone company had given him the old phone number of Sir Mix-a-Lot.
And on August 12th, the rapper's birthday, Nichols got all of his happy birthday texts.
Among the headlines this week, we saw a big drop in stocks, partly attributable to continued worries about China's economy. Is it slowing down? Well, to answer that question, we're joined by Clayton Duby. He's director of USC's U.S.-China Institute, and he's here to tell us, Wither China. Hi, Clayton.
Hello there.
So it's been very alarming, not just for investors, but people who have skin in the game through their 401ks, through their pension plans. The Chinese economy suddenly is a thing. Now, after many years of supercharged growth, they're not shrinking, but they're not growing quite as fast. Is that alarming?
No, it's to be expected. You're quite right that China has had extraordinary growth for better than three decades. It's natural that as its economy becomes so much bigger, that it would also mature. And mature economies don't grow as rapidly. The low-hanging fruit has already been picked. And so now they're reaching for some more difficult targets.
Part of the rap on China, though, is that the economy is being goosed by the government and that the growth we're seeing might not be honest growth.
Well, it's hard to categorize any growth as honest or dishonest. What you can talk about in China is growth that's driven by government stimulus, building roads here, there, and everywhere, building dams, building all sorts of infrastructure. That has been what has propelled China for better than three decades. And for a couple of years, they've been talking about ratcheting that back in favor of consumer-led growth, where individuals would be driving the economy as opposed to the government itself. But when there was a drop, the government has gotten nervous and is back to its old tricks.
And we saw with the stock market plunges over there that the government or whoever oversees the stock market didn't hesitate to step in and influence things or do their best to do so. Does that show a measured response or does that show something that should alarm Westerners?
Well, what it shows is that the Chinese government is new at this and that in terms of managing a free market, it's something that they're not very good at yet. They're not very good at telegraphing what they're going to do. They're not very good at talking it through. And so movement in interest rates, movement in the value of the currency has been done suddenly and has taken people by surprise. And when people are surprised, they tend to panic. And we've seen that in the Chinese markets over the last 5-6 months.
I've always been a little confused how a one-party, communist-party-led government can run a capitalistic economy. Aren't these two things mutually exclusive?
Not mutually exclusive. What they call their economy is a socialist market economy. And the state is a giant player. All the banks, the major banks, all state-owned. Telecommunications companies, all state-owned. Oil companies, all state-owned. The electric power supplier, state-owned. So the Chinese state is a major player, and with that kind of capital resources can make a big difference. At the same time, the private sector of China's economy has enlarged dramatically. And in fact, in terms of manufacturing, it's all private. The private players are the dominant ones. Now, what we're seeing is growth in services. About half of Chinese GDP now comes from services. This is a big transition, moving in the direction of the United States, where 70 to 80% of our economy is in services.
In the U.S., consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds of all economic activity. You go to the store and it seems like almost everything is made in China. Is that alarming or is that just it's a small world after all?
It's a very small world, and it's not just that so much is made in China, but also that China is putting a lot of money into the United States. And so, for example, in 2015, more than $10 billion of the $60 billion that Chinese companies invested abroad came to the United States.
So I don't want to pull all my 401k stocks out of Chinese-related stocks.
It'd be hard to do. All of the Fortune 500 companies here in the United States have big plays in China. So it would be hard to find a large American company that isn't making a big bid in China. McDonald's, Yum Brands, which owns KFC, all of these folks heavily into China. Most recently, the big meeting in China for Starbucks. Howard Schultz has gone there and expects that one day, the Chinese Starbucks market is going to be bigger than the American Starbucks market.
Clayton Doobie is director of USC's U.S.-China Institute. Clayton, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For the past year, Britain's Victoria and Albert Museum has been researching Chinese innovation in Shenzhen, a city sometimes known as the counterfeit capital of China. It's part of the research for a new design museum being co-founded by the Victoria and Albert and the state-backed China Merchants Group. Some of the findings are on display at Shenzhen's Biennale of Urbanism and Architecture. And as Jennifer Pack from our partners at the BBC reports, counterfeit goods, or Shanghai, have an important place.
On the western tip of Shenzhen City, hundreds of people tour the abandoned Dacheng flour mill. Like many factories in China, it shut down after the global financial crisis. Today, this factory has reopened its doors to house the Biennale and get people talking about innovation. As this video at the V&A exhibit explains, China's factories are skilled at copying big brands, referred to in Chinese as Shanzhai. In front of me is what looks like an Apple Watch, but runs on an Android system. The counterfeits have become more sophisticated because of the progress in one development, universal circuit boards. David Li from the Shenzhen Open Innovation Lab explains.
Anyone can buy, put a case on it, and ship it. Say, okay, well, I have a crazy idea. I can go in and realize it. No longer the innovation is limited by my access to technology, or my access to design, or my access to manufacturers.
So what may have started out as copies of big brands now have modifications that, the V&A argues, can sometimes be even better than the original. Curator Brendan Cormier shows me a cheap red mobile phone on their display.
So essentially it's a very simple phone geared towards a seniors market, and it does just a very, very few things. Bigger buttons, louder sound effects, an SOS button. It was a market that was completely ignored by the larger phone companies.
The V&A says this Shanzhai exhibit has caused the most controversy. Again, Brendan Cormier.
And I think what's important to show here is it's not that we're trying to promote counterfeit goods. What we're trying to say is that the ecosystem, because it really is an ecosystem which allows Shanzhai to exist, it's allowing for many small-scale innovations within the mobile industry.
And the V&A didn't stop there.
We are producing knitwear for customers all over the world.
In another video display, it found innovation at a clothing factory. This exhibit is a taste of what we can see in Shenzhen's upcoming design museum, co-founded by the V&A and China Merchants Group. It's a big deal because the V&A receives and rejects many offers from around the world to work together. So why did it agree to do this project, which is its biggest outside of Europe? The answer lies in its history, according to the V&A's Luisa Mangoni, who is overseeing the partnership.
When the V&A was founded in 1852, it was really in response to the need of British manufacturers and factories to develop their own design and to have more innovation. A very similar phenomenon is happening now in Shenzhen.
That combination of manufacturing and design can come in many forms. Brendan Cormier showed me more of the exhibition.
Okay, we're going to move further down here to another display where there are four, are they oil paintings on canvas?
They're all the same image. It's of a ballerina in a kind of impressionistic style. Three of the images are oil paintings on canvas, and one of them is a digital print on canvas.
Okay, so what are you trying to show me here? This is how painters in Dafan Village, a very popular area where people replicate and reproduce famous paintings or any painting.
So I think what's so interesting about Dafan is that it's really emerged into a cultural industrial production chain. So you can look at the whole village as a kind of loosely aggregated factory of independent producers, and they're all connected to sales agents. There's support infrastructure like frame makers. There are people who will print out onto canvas digital images, which makes copying faster. So there's a lot of small-scale kind of tweaks to Dafan Village to make it run more efficiently like a machine.
How hard was it for you to change and adjust and to see the design aspect in some of these reproductions?
When we first started this project, we wanted to understand how can we understand Shenzhen as a design city. And to do so, you have to go through a personal kind of exercise of changing or altering a lot of your biases or assumptions about design. So assumptions about design being driven by a singular author, that painting is all about individual creativity. That has to be shifted to an idea that painting is about craft and technique.
But was it hard for you?
It was fun for us to adjust.
It was very fun and very interesting.
The BBC's Jennifer Pack.
of the regular things we do on the show is look into an economic story that you bring to our attention. It's a segment we call Local Money. This week, we got an email from listener Tim Baer. He asked why many of the roads in California are still in poor condition, considering the state has a budget surplus. And that kind of reminded us of the headline in The Onion a few years ago that read, "We must repaint our nation's crumbling infrastructure." It seems to me duct tape is also good in situations like that. Unfortunately, Bayer's sentiment is nothing new. Dilapidated infrastructure is something the entire nation deals with. And the reason for that, well, it all comes down to, you guessed it, money. Here to tell us more is Kelly Madrick. She's the transportation reporter for CQ Roll Call. Hiya, Kelly.
Glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about what the listener says here, because it's very interesting. We're all driving on dilapidated roads and bridges. And here in L.A., I'm constantly hitting potholes and thinking, why isn't anyone doing anything about this? So why isn't anyone doing anything about this?
So there's a lot of different people doing things about this, and that might be part of the problem. I mean, when you look at road and bridge transportation issues nationwide, we have problems when it comes to the federal program, the state program, and the interplay between both of those. So when you're driving on a state highway in California, it's not just state officials and state budgets you have to worry about, but the federal budget as well. And when it comes to the federal transportation program, we've been in something of a limbo since 2008, some would argue earlier, where we're constantly encountering these funding shortfalls caused by an imbalance between motor fuels taxes that pay states for federal transportation projects and the spending levels that have been authorized by Congress.
And let's talk about that, because drivers routinely gripe about gas taxes and lose track of the fact that if it wasn't for gas taxes, they'd be four-wheeling over dirt roads.
It's a very complicated issue because on the state level, there's plenty of states across the country who have raised their own gas taxes, California included. But then on the federal level, gas taxes haven't been raised since 1993. And when you're looking at big highway and bridge projects, 80% of the costs are funded by the federal government. So we have a funding source that hasn't increased since 1993 that's paying for programs. Congress wants to spend more, so what have they done? They've had this kind of stop-and-start funding system where they transfer money from general fund revenues into this big highway trust fund. It's kind of like the bank account that reimburses states for projects. And then states have to go in and put in their 20%. And in the case of California, their budgets have been all over the place. They have a revenue surplus this year. But in past years, California's borrowed from transportation funding in order to meet their own shortfalls.
So let me see if I've got this right. People want there to be spending on the big infrastructure projects. Congress wants to spend on these things. However, Congress doesn't want to raise taxes to do it, even though it doesn't have enough revenue coming in from taxes to cover it. So instead, it plays a shell game with its finances to bamboozle us into thinking that there's money that isn't really there.
You nailed it in a pretty good way. But another way to kind of think about it, too, is that lawmakers have signed a no new taxes pledge. Plenty of them follow this pledge that's been put together by Grover Norquist, a big conservative leader. And so a gas tax is off the table, even though that is the one discrete and major revenue source for transportation. The result is that this year we passed a five-year, $305 billion transportation reauthorization bill. $70 billion of that came from transferring money from general fund revenues. And in order to do that, Congress has set up rules that they have to do what's called offset that by cutting spending elsewhere or increasing revenue somehow. The majority of that money came not from transportation sources, but from changing Federal Reserve programs and cutting money from the Federal Reserve of all places.
And even if the feds don't come through, then it's up to the state, then it's up to counties and municipalities to deal with these issues. And in the past, we've seen borrowing, bond floats, not to put too fine a point on it. Are we still seeing aggressive issuance of bonds to cover these big ticket projects?
Some states are going aggressively after bond issuance, but also there's only so much debt that states can take on. Alternatively, they could raise gas taxes, but even that is going to be kind of difficult to bridge this massive gap when it comes to moving transportation projects. Even with what seems to be a five-year kind of hiatus in terms of this federal chaos, at the end of that five-year period, they're going to land right back at a zero balance. And so we're going to be back in the same place that we were just in December.
And I imagine there's only so much transportation dollars and investment to go around. So in a place like California, where big bucks are being devoted to development of a high-speed rail network, which is going very slowly and very over budget, it's probably hard to make the case that there should be either more borrowing or more spending on traditional things like roads and bridges and other such stuff.
It's a theme that is repeated over and over again on Capitol Hill, that roads and bridges aren't sexy. And nobody's really found a way to make them that way. But in order to keep people from sitting in traffic constantly, politicians and local and state government leaders and federal leaders are going to try to they're going to have to try to find a way to do that.
Kelly Madrick is transportation reporter with CQ Roll Call. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for asking me on the show.
Come tell us about the most important economic story where you live. Go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Local Money. Sometimes our experiences with money matter more than you'd think. That's why we came up with the Marketplace Quiz, to see how our experiences with money have shaped our lives. This week, our quiz guest is Davey Rothbart, filmmaker, author, and editor of Found Magazine. That's a pretty cool publication made up of letters, love notes, journal entries that readers send in. So Davey came into our studios in downtown LA to take stock.
My name is Davey Rothbart, and I'm a writer and filmmaker, and I also make a magazine called Found. What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows? Well, so I make this magazine called Found Magazine, and people send in these incredible notes from all over the world. Love notes, to-do lists, journal entries, really personal, moving stuff. And some of it's heartbreaking, some of it's hilarious. But the truth is that, you know, some of these just make me laugh out loud, and I can't wait to show them to my friends and put them in the magazine. But I also am privy to a lot of human sadness, you know, like there's so many people that just want things so badly that they're not going to get, and they're kind of spilling themselves out either in a letter to a friend or in a journal, a letter to themselves. Sometimes it can take a toll on you, and you almost feel like feeling, and it's not that one note is so acutely sad, it's just like the accumulated weight of all of these notes. In a next life, what would your career be? You know, I always dreamed of being an NBA player, and then I just realized, you know, I'm too short, I'm not quite 6 feet. It seemed impossible. Watching Steph Curry go nuts this year? Wow, I probably should have put a little more time into my jumper in high school. Who knows what would have happened. So my next life, I'll definitely be in the NBA playing for the Detroit Pistons. All right, what is your most prized possession? I used to live in New Mexico, and I traded my car for this necklace that I've worn every day for the last 15 years. And it was one of those trades that works out great for everybody involved, because there was this hairdresser named JR, and I used to always see him at the bar. And he was notorious for bumming rides from people. JR would, he'd always be hitting you up, and you'd think he, sometimes he'd tell you about a cool party, so you would answer your phone, but like 90% of the time, he was just trying to get a ride somewhere. Well, I was moving out of New Mexico back to Chicago, and I knew this car I had at the time. I knew the car would never make it that far. It still was a good around-town car in Taos, New Mexico. So I always coveted this necklace that JR had. It's kind of a silver, finely woven chain. It looks badass, and it has like a real weight to it, a real heft. And so I just made this crazy offer to JR one night at the bar. I was like, dude, I'm leaving town next week. My car for your necklace, what do you say? He thought about it. Let me get back to you. The next day, call me up. Let's do it. I've had this necklace, and I've worn it every day for the last 16 years. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career? Charles Baxter was my professor at University of Michigan. He used to say, just write a lot and read a lot. And he said, read the same books over and over again to kind of learn about their interior architecture. And, you know, even write out the sentences, your favorite paragraphs. Just try typing them out just to, like, do that. And also, people told me, you know, don't expect it to happen all at once. Like, you know, you're not going to become a widely read writer the first thing you write. It takes years. What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost? I would say a baseball mitt. I got one recently, and I've been going to Elysian Park, which is just near downtown LA, and I've been going over there with a baseball and actually a spare mitt, but it's the most pleasing thing just to go play catch. I'd forgotten that pure joy of that. And then sometimes if I don't go there with a friend, there's always a kid running around there that wants to play, and just to be tossing a baseball back and forth with some 12-year-old kid from the neighborhood and just, like, talking about life, it's the perfect thing.
Davey Rothbart is a filmmaker and author of My Heart is an Idiot. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our regular guide to tech in real life on the show. How you doing, Ben?
I'm a little annoyed, I got to say. You haven't accepted my friend request on Facebook.
Yeah, there's that. But
or you didn't follow me back on Twitter either.
There's that. But
yeah, you didn't add me on Peach either. Just saying.
Add you on what?
Peach.
What's that?
You haven't heard of Peach?
I know that it's like a character in Super Mario. Ooh, nails it.
Well done, well done.
Thank you much.
David, is also the new social network hotness this week, the Peach flavor of the week, if you will. Peach is a new social media platform. It's made by Dom Hoffman. He was the co-founder at Vine, which you may remember as that short video platform, the
that's
Twitter
like
bot.
5 seconds of video that's supposed to be artistic.
Yeah. 6 second videos. Yep. And over the past week, Peach has gotten a lot of press and Twitter buzz. Right now, it's top 10 downloaded on the iOS store, the App Store. It's not on Android, so maybe not everyone has a Peach account. But it's growing, and people are checking it out, which is, I suppose, half the battle in some ways.
Well, wait a minute. Okay, so I got my Twitter, I got my Facebook, I got my Instagram, yeah. I got my LinkedIn. I got social networks up the yazoo, and you're telling me I need another?
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to be where all the cool kids are, theoretically.
This is where I thought all the cool kids were on Instagram.
They are. And Peach, you know, we should say it's not like mind-blowingly groundbreaking here. It's sort of a mix between Twitter and Slack or maybe the Yo app, which you may remember. It's got a mix of text commands. You can send photos, drawings, messages to your friends. What makes it different is that there's not really a public stream that combines everything from your friends into one neat list. But you can send someone a piece of cake digitally. You can cake them. And, you know, I guess that's a thing.
Well, at last, my dreams have been met.
If only it were real cake.
I guess so. So what you just described is sort of like all the other rings, but not the ring that in the darkness binds them. What's the
point? Yes. It's another way to communicate, right? And, you know, social networks are really, that's what they're about fundamentally. Everybody loves to communicate. And this is still a really powerful argument for new users is like you can talk to other people. You can talk to other people in new ways. And we've seen a lot of social media networks flame out over the past year or so. You may remember the ghost that is Elo.
I remember that one.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be very cool for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, for about 10 minutes. But these communication apps, these applications or software that helps you communicate with people will continue, I think, to be really relevant. The skeptical view here is that we need to think about whether the latest communication offering, the latest – the peach of the week, if you will – keeps the people you want to talk to as users because that tells you whether it can keep you as a user, right?
Well, aside from this being yet another way that the person in front of me on the freeway can be distracted from what they should be doing, how are these guys at Peach going to be making any money?
This is a good question. I think there are a lot of different ways in which an app like this can make money. You could sell to another company that, you know, maybe Microsoft gets really excited about what you're doing at Peach and says, you know what, we want to fold Peach into Microsoft Outlook or something like that. And then they buy Peach for a gazillion dollars. And then you continue making your product as part of a larger company. It almost feels like they're designed to be a flash in the pan where, you know, I don't think any founder or co-founder would admit this outright necessarily. But sometimes people make stuff in order to catch the attention of people who might hire them for another job. It ends up being, in some ways, a resume builder in the tech world as much as it might be a real effective way to communicate. Now, I don't want to judge Peach in that way necessarily, but I do think that a lot of the things that are getting built and people are getting excited about, they do have a sort of meteoric existence in the tech world of today.
All right. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and my friend on MySpace. He's also our guide to tech IRL. Ben, as always, thank you so much.
See you on Friendster, David.
You bet. A new book looks at the way women influence our nation, with the idea that once women reach critical mass in any given professional sphere, change starts to happen. The book is called Broad Influence: How Women Are Changing the Way America Works, and J. Newton Small is the author. He's also the Washington correspondent for Time magazine. Lizzie and Jay are old friends. They recently sat down to talk about the book.
I want to start with this concept of critical mass, because a lot of writing about women in the workplace talks about parity and everything being equal. You don't do that. What is critical mass, and why did you find it so important in this book?
Well, the idea for the book came about 2 years ago when I was covering Congress, actually, the Senate. The women of the Senate had reached 20%, and it was the first time that they were at 20%, and they really, really batted above their weight. They ended up producing 75% of the major legislation that passed the Senate that session. And I started hearing from other friends of mine, you know, one friend in the, who's in the Navy, who talked about how Navy ships had reached a similar kind of feminine tipping point where when they got to between 20 and 25%, that was the goal for all Navy ships, because that's when things really normalized and became a good situation. And then women in the corporate world talked to me about how there's this 30% club in New York and in the UK and Canada where it aims to have women reach 30% in all corporate boards, because, again, it was kind of a tipping point. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. So I started researching this idea, and it turns out that it's pretty widespread, and not just in corporate boards and Navy ships, but also in appellate courts and in all kinds of, you know, corners of the workforce. And so the book kind of grew out of that.
When you talk about critical mass, the numbers are there in the public sector, but not in the private. Why?
There are a number of reasons, and that was one of the sort of striking findings of the book, that the public sector is reaching critical mass in all three branches of the government. And that's striking because 10 years ago, it was the private sector that led the public sector.
Yeah.
But they haven't made any progress since. And that's sort of for a number of reasons. One, women vote a lot more than men do, about 10% more on average, and so they tend to swing elections. And two, there's much more of a sense of accountability to voters and to the public and to the press in the public sector than you have in the private sector. Three, you have much stronger unions in the public sector than you do in the private sector, so it's a lot harder to sort of fire a woman or edge them out when they have children. And then four, there's just an easier on-ramping in the public sector than there is in the private sector. So if you look at New Hampshire, for example, it's the most representative democracy in our nation. It has a lower house of more than 400 members representing 3 million people. And it's a very small leap to go from running from school board to state legislature. And it's a part-time job like it is in 34 other states. Women who have children can easily do it. And as their kids get older, they can then spend more time there. They can run for higher office. They can start chairing committees. At one point in the last 5 years, the entire delegation was women, right? So two members of the House, two members of the Senate, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the AG, all women. And that shows you how women in the public sector have a much easier on-ramping path than women in the private sector, which tends to be all or nothing. You're working full-time or not at all, and there's not a lot of part-time prospects.
You and I both covered Washington, and Washington can be a very male-dominated place. I want you to take me back to President Obama's first term and this meeting where the two female deputy chiefs of staff, Alyssa Mastromonaco and Nancy Ann DeParle, barge into the Oval Office. What happened?
So, as you know, as when we covered it together, the Obama White House started out very much as a boys' club. And the women really had a hard time breaking through. They had a hard time being heard. And it got so bad, but by the end of the first year, they had a dinner with him in the residence, and they basically aired all these complaints about how they weren't making any headway and no one was listening to them. And the president listened to them, but then basically said, you know what? Step up. There's no real excuse for this. You guys have got to rely on each other. You guys have got to get each other's backs. And he almost offhandedly at the end of the dinner suggested that they started getting together regularly themselves. And up until that point, the women of the White House didn't really know each other that well. When they started to get together following the president's advice, they started to really realize that they needed to kind of work together the way the men work together. And that is, you know, like form social bonds, but also protect each other. And they really began to then have real critical mass. They began to really have an impact. And in this scene that you're talking about, it was Nancy Andoparo, Alyssa Mastromonaco, and Stephanie Cutter, and they'd been cut out of meetings having to do with the debt ceiling negotiations, the big grand bargain negotiations in the middle of 2011. And so they heard about a meeting one Sunday where the president was having with David Plouffe, who's his political advisor, and his chief of staff, Bill Daley, in the Oval. And they just sort of were like, you know what? This is ridiculous. We're just gonna walk into the meeting. And they just barged into the Oval Office uninvited and sat down and started participating in the meeting as if nothing was wry. And the guys just kind of looked at them and the president said, well, hi, guys. And they were like, hi. And everyone got the point. and after that, they were never excluded again.
Valerie Jarrett was one of the president's closest confidants. What was her White House experience like?
So Valerie is best friends with both the president and with the first lady, and she was there throughout all the meetings in the White House. She was there when the women at the dinner, when women felt disgruntled and they took their concerns to the president. She helped the women start monthly dinners, which they continue to this day, that she still somewhat oversees. So she's been a force in bringing these issues to the forefront in terms of policy.
But there's an ooh in your voice when I ask that.
Well, you know, she's very loyal to the president and to the first lady. And I think that she didn't take kindly to the suggestion that women were somehow being discriminated against when this first happened early on. But ultimately, she did, you know, she did organize the monthly dinners and she did become very much a champion of the issues and a champion of a lot of the women in the White House.
I have one last question for you. You dedicate this book to your mother, who died a few years ago, who worked for the United Nations in a very male-dominated era. What do you wish she'd seen?
I wish she'd seen. My mom, you know, had such a hard time at work, and she really faced so much harassment, and she was miserable. And I often saw her crying, just weeping at the kitchen table as a child. And so I guess I'd like for her to see that, you know, as alone as she was in her career, I have a whole class of friends, of colleagues who are women who are with me. And so that when I face something akin to what she faced, which is actually rarer and rarer these days, I have a whole group of people around me to support me, and I'm not alone. And that, to me, is the power of critical mass, that we don't feel like the odd person out or the odd couple of people out, that we have each other to support each other, to talk things through, and it helps us succeed and it helps us get further in our careers. And I wish that she'd been able to see that.
Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, thank you.
Thank you.
Newton Small's book, Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works, is out now. And that's our show for this week. Lizzie's back next week, and in the meantime, we want to keep the conversation going. When it comes to your money and your personal economy, what's the biggest issue you want the next president to tackle? Let us know by visiting our website, marketplaceweekend.org, chatting with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or calling 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Madhavan and Haley Hirschman. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm David Lazarus, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.